Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. With about a month left in the 2017 session of the Oklahoma Legislature, there's still no plan or agreement from legislators on how to fill an estimated state budget shortfall in excess of $850 million. While some modest revenue enhancements have passed this session, as well as a wind energy tax incentive has been curtailed for a future year, which will lead to more revenue down the road, very little has been accomplished to fix the structure of what Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon referred to as the state's structural budget deficit. While budget negotiations are still taking place with the majority party behind closed doors, Democrats have released their blueprint, and last week a coalition of several dozen organizations operating under the name of Save Our State announced a three-year state budget blueprint to eliminate this year's shortfall and protect essential government services, get the state back on an even keel as far as its revenue for the state. One of those organizations is the Oklahoma Policy Institute, and I'm joined today by David Blatt, the executive director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute, to talk about the Save Our State Coalition and the proposals they make to balance the state budget. David Blatt, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You remember the Save Our State Coalition that announced a budget blueprint in the wake of the fact that despite legislative leaders saying they were going to have a laser-like focus on the budget, so far we have not seen the laser light yet.
No.
The laser light is behind closed doors, if it's occurring at all. Why did this consortium of groups get together?
So Oklahoma Policy Institute, my organization, is part of a couple of dozen organizations that came together because we are deeply troubled with where we are as a state. We know that we are in a situation almost of unprecedented crisis in Oklahoma, given the budget cuts that we have suffered over the last several years, and looking ahead to the prospect of deeper cuts going forward. And what we decided, along with a wide range of groups, which includes teacher organizations, public employees, social workers, League of Women Voters, many other organizations, that we really needed to do something, and that we could be providing a service to put together a proposal, present it to legislators, and say, here's a plan. You may not choose to endorse the entire plan, and we're not expecting that they're going to embrace every single aspect of it, but here is a plan that meets some basic goals of averting deeper cuts to public services, investing in some key priorities, and perhaps most importantly, putting our budget on a balanced, sustainable path and moving away from the one-time revenue measures and the budget gimmicks that we've become really dependent on for quite a few years.
Now, as we look at the situation in the legislature this year, there are some actions being proposed. None of them really huge game changers. Well, maybe the gross production tax, which is still under debate,
sure,
of changing that. But, you know, the bill that would stop future income tax, that doesn't really help us in this year.
Right. Well, let's go back to the start of session where Governor Fallon presented a budget plan that was notable in a couple of ways. First of all, she quite frankly stated that Oklahoma has a revenue problem, that we're not bringing in enough revenue to pay for the cost of services. And she used a term that we've talked about forever, of a structural budget deficit. She's recognizing that the problems we have are not simply or primarily tied to low energy prices, but that we really have found ourselves in a system where our tax revenue is not adequate to be able to fund our schools and provide mental health services and ensure public safety and maintain state parks and do the things that people expect from state government. So the governor and her plan put forward a broad range of revenue proposals, which some folks liked some of them, some folks liked others, very few people liked all of them, but at least it was a plan that served as a starting point. Subsequent to that, you had the House Democrats released their plan. Legislative leaders at this point have talked a lot about that they're working on a budget. They've acknowledged that we have a severe budget crisis, but up to now, legislative leaders, the Republican leadership in the House of Senate, have not really tipped their hand as to what their proposal or what their plan is going to be. So we felt that it was important to bring something to the table and say, here's a way we can move forward.
So how did you guys hammer this out? Did you have like your own mini legislature to sort of hammer out these proposals?
One of the groups that we're working with, Stand for Children, which is primarily an education group, education advocacy group, but they're aware that if students are going to succeed, they not only need well-qualified teachers who are able to earn a decent salary. That's obviously very important when you look at what's happened in our state and the crisis that we're facing with teacher recruitment and retention. So our plan includes an immediate $5,000 pay raise for teachers, but that couldn't be the entire solution because if kids come to school hungry and in poor health and not getting the mental health services they need, then students are not going to succeed. And if the state as a whole is falling apart, then students are not going to succeed.
You can't just pay teachers more. The teachers have to have the resources within the school system to do their job.
Right, and outside the school system too, because students and families are parts of communities. So what Stan did is they led this process and then reached out to us and to other organizations. They knew that we've been working on the budget for a long time and had ideas. And they contracted with a couple of folks who have very long experience with state government, who've served as the state budget director, who've served as a tax commissioner, and they really got in there and hammered out the nitty-gritty of the proposal. What are all the various revenue options? How do we put together a plan that meets those goals of putting the state on a more sustainable path forward? What's interesting about this plan, I should mention that it is available online at SaveOurStateOK.org, where you can see a summary and then really dive into the whole blueprint for a better budget. What you have in this plan is a very detailed three-year proposal that allows us to fund our main priorities, but also makes sure that the budget is genuinely balanced and eases us off this reliance on one-time funding using money from agency revolving funds,
rainy day funds. Sell-off of state assets.
We actually avoid that entirely in this budget. Yeah. But last year, for example, in order to get everything to balance, the state issued $200 million in transportation bonds. Basically, took money that typically goes to the Department of Transportation, moved that over into general revenue, and then had the Department of Transportation issue $200 million of bonds. That was probably essential to get some budget through, but that was one-time revenue. We're acknowledging that in all likelihood, we're going to have to do that again one more time. But the SOS budget, Save Our State budget that we put forward over a three-year period weans us entirely off of one-time revenue, puts us on a true sustainable path.
I think you use rainy day funds as well in this budget. But before we actually get into the details, one of the big hurdles for passing revenue increases in the state is the state question 640, which requires supermajorities. Does anything in this proposal require that sort of majorities?
There are aspects of this plan that would unquestionably require a three-quarters vote of the legislature. And certainly that has been a pretty difficult obstacle to overcome over the last 25, 30 years since passage of State Question 640, which was in 1992. We've only had one instance of the voters approving a tax increase. That was 2004 with the tobacco tax increase. There have been a couple of small revenue measures that have gotten a three-quarters majority. Our plan includes a broad range of revenue options. They were designed to try to be fair, to make sure that everybody is paying some, but not everybody is, nobody's paying everything. So one thing we do is restore a top income tax rate of 6% on very high incomes. That would require the supermajority. We also do follow the proposal of the governor of the healthcare community to raise the tobacco tax by $1.50 a pack. There's a motor fuels increase to bring Oklahoma to the national average in terms of gasoline and diesel taxes. It would go to about 24 cents a gallon. Those are probably the main components of the plan that would almost certainly require the supermajority. There's some others where you might have a bit of a back and forth between legal experts as to whether they would count as revenue measures under the terms of the Constitution.
My guest today is David Blatt, Executive Director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute. He and a group of several dozen organizations across the state formed a Save Our State Coalition and announced a state budget blueprint last week to eliminate this year's shortfall and protect essential government services and also put us on a sort of a runway for running a state without ongoing
budget.
Yeah, balanced budget and no more shortfalls down the road. So as I look at this, you're using rainy day funds. You're going to, in this first year, you would use some one-time funds from a rainy day and maybe some revolving funds, but then that would end in this year. And then one of the first things you mentioned is changing our motor vehicle taxes by changing to a two-year vehicle tag. How does this add money and save money at the same time?
Sure. There's a version of this that has been moving through the legislature. Right now, Oklahomans pay an annual car tag. The proposal that we put out there is to move to a two-year tag. And under our plan, those who do this, there would be a 5% discount. So you would not pay you pay slightly less than the full amount. What that allows us is that in those first couple of years where rather than paying, let's say, $80 in year one and then $75 in year two, we would get that additional money, the $150, let's say, in year one. So it's a little bit of a bump. Probably is a better idea for folks to be able to get that car tag renewed every 2 years rather than having to remember and go off to the tag agency or send it off to the Oklahoma Tax Commission. So that's among our proposals, maybe a little on the gimmicky side.
I was going to say, isn't that a little gimmicky there?
It's a little gimmicky, but we're looking for ways. Some of the proposals are going to be more painful. Some are less painful. But what we're really keeping the focus is on, we have a crisis here where we have cut core services year after year after year, and we have to do something. And I think the citizens recognize that we need to take bold measures, and legislators recognize we need to take bold measures. I was talking to a freshman senator this year who said, we have to do something different. He said, I didn't go into public office in order to face this kind of a situation every year for my 8 or 12 years of service. I don't want to just be lurching from crisis to crisis. So we need a sustainable path. We need to really address these chronic budget shortfalls. And we need to take real measures to begin to reverse the declines that we've seen in our schools, in our healthcare systems, in public safety, in all these areas.
Yeah. Before we go back to some of the aspects of the plan, let me just sort of follow up on that. The chair of the Appropriations Committee, Leslie Osborne, basically sent out to state agencies, what would a 14.5% cut look like? Is this a serious proposal, or is this almost a piece of rhetoric to get legislators to really consider some meaningful changes?
Unfortunately, Rich, it isn't. We have anywhere from a $750 million to $1 billion budget hole next year, and we've run out of one-time options. You know, we heard a few weeks ago that the Office of Management and Enterprise Services was borrowing money from the Rainy Day Fund to be able to make monthly agency allocations. That's never happened before, that they've had to reach into the Rainy Day Fund and borrow from there with the expectation and hope that they can repay the money before the end of the year so that we can tap into it to help us through next year. We are broke. And a lot of the gimmicks and one-time things that we've done in the past, we just don't have that option any longer, even if we wanted to, and we shouldn't be doing it that way. So what Representative Osborne did, to her credit, was to bring agencies to the legislature and say, look, if we don't take some of these difficult but sensible measures to put our revenue system on stable footing, then we're going to be looking at 15% cuts. And what's that going to mean? What's that going to mean to schools if they take a 10 to 15% cut? What is that going to mean for higher ed? What's it going to mean to Medicaid? Well, the healthcare authority has said we're looking at having to cut all of our provider rates by 25 to 30%. That's going to mean that rural hospitals are going to close. That's going to mean nursing homes are going to close. It's going to devastate our healthcare system across the state. For those who receive DHS services through in-home waivers, for seniors and those with disabilities, for children in the child welfare system, these are going to be devastating cuts. I've hesitated for a long time to say that lives are at stake, but lives are at stake now. We've seen what's happened in our veterans care facilities where they don't have enough money to provide adequate staffing, and veterans have died. We see what's going on now with children in DHS custody. We have the most vulnerable members of our population whose lives are at stake. And for families and communities and businesses, if we're not willing to take some tough decisions this year, the impact across a whole range of services that we count on for our safety and well-being really is at risk.
Now, right now, the sort of budget committee of the whole legislature are sort of hammering out what they hope will be a balanced budget. But there are so many members of the legislature. You know, there are a number of members of the legislature who say, basically, philosophically, I'm not here to add to the tax burden of Oklahomans. How do you get those guys' votes?
Sure. There are some legislators who said absolutely hell no to any tax increase. But there's not that many of them. What it does mean is when you have a supermajority requirement, so in the House, that means 76 members. In the Senate, it means, now I'm trying to do math, 36 out of 48. So you would need 36 members who would support a tax increase. Most of the drama is going to be on the House side, because in the House, you have roughly now 72 Republicans and 25 Democrats with several vacancies that have opened up. There are not enough Republicans to get a tax increase through, even if every one of them voted yes, which is not going to happen because you do have these hardcore tax opponents. So the Republican leadership knows that if they're going to get a tobacco tax increase through or a fuel tax increase through, they're going to need the votes of the House Democrats. And the House Democrats have clearly said they're not going to support tax increases that the Republicans are talking about, fuel and tobacco, without either restoring the gross production tax, the tax on oil and gas, back up either to the full 7% or perhaps the 5%, or raising the income tax rate back to where it was before we started cutting taxes. So those have been the Democrats' bottom lines, and they've held firm and said one of those two things has to be in any plan before they're going to deliver votes from the Democrats.
So in essence, they're saying you can't balance the budget with total regressive taxes. You have to have a mix of regressive
and
progressive.
That's what they're saying. And in our plan, the Save Our State plan, we do have a mix. We include the cigarette tax increase, which has some real benefits to it as well in terms of
reducing smoking rates.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But if we're going to have, our plan said, if we're going to have more regressive tax increases, the cigarette tax increase, the motor fuels tax increase, on that one, it's important to recognize that Oklahoma has not raised its motor fuel tax since 1987. We were 17 cents on gasoline and 14 cents on diesel back then. As inflation has increased over the years, that excise tax has remained where it is. So moving it up to 24, 25 cents a gallon really would just put us in line with other states and make up for the changes over time in inflation. But our plan as well says it needs to be balanced. We also strongly support restoring the gross production tax. That one, we're still losing $400 to $500 million a year because we're subsidizing production with this 2% rate for the first 3 years of production. That's one that we've been talking about quite a bit and seems to be exceptionally popular with the public and even among a good number of legislators. There's just
a certain number of oil men, for that matter.
A certain number of oil men, although obviously less than unanimous. But we saw that group, the Oklahoma Energy Producers Association, led by former Mayor Bartlett here in Tulsa and some other veteran people from the oil and gas industry who've come forward and said, let's go back to taxing oil and gas adequately, because the services that we're not funding, a quality education system, infrastructure, healthcare, those are essential to oil and gas companies as well as all of our businesses and all of our families.
And that 7% rate, which a rough, well, I think you were actually a little less than 7, maybe 6 point, you know, some change there. That's still going to be lower than North Dakota. How many other states that we think of as most, the domestic real producers now?
Most every Texas? State. If we were back to 7%, so you have to remember that Oklahoma established a 7% rate on gross production back in the 1970s, and that was the standard set rate. In the 1990s, when horizontal drilling was a new and experimental, expensive technique, the legislature passed a narrow tax break for horizontal drilling of 1% for the first 4 years. As recently as 2004, that was a $4 million tax break. But as more and more production went to horizontal wells, that tax break, taxing it at 1% rather than 7%, that became a $200, $300, $400 million tax break. 3 years ago, the legislature created a what they said was going to be a permanent exemption for all wells at 2% for the first 3 years. What that meant is if you look at the effective rate, the average tax rate on all production in the state, we fall into about 3%. We're taxing oil and gas at less than half the standard rate. So it's been encouraging to see some within the industry come and say, let's do away with that tax break, go back to 7%. There have been others who've talked about a 5% rate for all production. Whatever you do to restore the rate is certainly going to provide some substantial help to our budget situation.
Now, your blueprint also calls for not only a higher rate, a top rate, but it also provides for changes in how income taxes are calculated. For example, eliminating special capital gains deductions being claimed by Oklahoma corporations, or eliminating the affordable housing credit and some other things like that. Will those require supermajorities, or can the state basically change the rules of how tax are collected as long as the rates don't change?
That's where you would get into debate. I'm of the view that if you are just doing away
with exemptions,
curbing a tax break, then that doesn't require the supermajority. So one that you mentioned is a tax break that was passed in 2004, I believe, that said that if you sell Oklahoma-held stocks or property, that you don't have to pay state taxes on the capital gains that you claim. Now, that's a over $100 million tax break. It mostly benefits upper-income families or taxpayers.
Probably helps shareholders within that company,
that's Oklahoma company.
That's right. Yeah.
And it hasn't really been proven to really encourage or stimulate investment. So that's one of many things in this proposal where we say, look, the tax code is riddled with preferences and subsidies for various interests. You can argue on each of these, but what we're saying is we need to do away with a broad range of them. So we do away with the tax break for capital gains. We do away with the tax break for oil and gas. We do away, substantially curb the tax break for wind, coal, affordable housing. These are all things that when we are facing a genuine budget crisis, when schools aren't able to keep their doors open for 5 days a week, where we're not able to retain teachers and losing state employees, when mental health providers and all these others are really struggling, then we have to choose our priorities. And I think that what we're saying and what we're hearing from Oklahomans is the priority should be to fund our core services and to put the budget back into balance.
Now, right now we're in a crisis situation. Down the road, if we actually do, as they say, we heard T.R. Reid last week on this show talking about the idea of broadening the base, then you can lower the rates. If we actually get rid of a lot of these exemptions, tax credits that are riddled throughout the tax code, could we actually see lower rates for the average individual income taxpayer down the road?
It's possible. I think we're several years from that debate. You mentioned before the legislation that has been sailing rather smoothly through the legislature this year to repeal the next scheduled income tax cut. So 3 years ago, the legislature approved a two-phase tax cut with each of these cuts in the top income tax rate, first from 5.25% down to 5% and then down to 4.85%, tied to a tax cut trigger tied to future growth. Well, last year, in the midst of two revenue failures, in the midst of a $1.3 billion shortfall, the way that bill was written, that tax cut trigger took effect and our top income tax rate was cut from 5.25% to 5%. It was absolutely ridiculous that they had written a bill that allowed that to happen. They would not go back and revisit it. Well, now the legislature at least has recognized not to do that, not to let that happen again. So the way that the bill had been written, this next tax cut down to 4.85% could have taken effect as early as 2019 if we saw the slightest revenue growth. And so I think the legislature, by supporting Senate Bill 170, which has now passed both chambers and should be headed to the governor soon, what they're saying, first of all, it's going to take several years before we're ready for even a debate about the next tax cut, and then we shouldn't be deciding tax cuts in the future based on some arbitrary trigger.
Yeah. One last area, and that is broadening sales taxes and doing sales taxes on services. Now, the governor proposed that, and it was like a skeet shoot when she first proposed it. But you were also proposing that. Now, what areas? I know it's like delivery, any delivery, installation or repair services, oil field services, digital goods, custom software. Where are the main areas? Are those the main areas?
You've identified several of them. So the idea that we're supporting is that there are more services that should be taxed. That's part of the broadening of the tax base that you talked about that helps modernize the economy. You know, we have a economy that is increasingly based on consumption of services and then purchase of goods online. And we have a sales tax that is really focused on the consumption of goods and increasingly where we're not able to even tax many of the purchases that are made online. So we do need to modernize the sales tax base. The sales tax is crucial not just for the state budget, but also for our municipal and county budgets. So we do include taxation on some services. We wanted to look at services that are taxed by most neighboring states and that are primarily a more luxury items, not the haircuts and car repairs. So we've included some services, obviously far fewer than what the governor proposed. Her plan, at least to start the discussion, was to tax every service. And that was, you know, quite the political non-starter. Her plan probably didn't make sense from a policy standpoint, much less from a political standpoint. But at the same time, it shouldn't be an all or nothing thing. It shouldn't be a question of, well, we're going to tax every single service or none. It's worth having a discussion of which services would be worth including.
Well, you can read a lot more at saveourstateok.org, where the blueprint exists. And hopefully some legislatures are looking at it. Have you had any reaction from legislatures?
We've had very good reaction from legislators. I had one ask me today, well, are you guys insisting that we accept all of it or nothing? And we said, no. You know, there's going to be a number of things here. We hope that you will lean more towards all than nothing, but they're going to have to hear from constituents. So we're really urging people to go to saveourstateok.org and contact their legislators and let them know that we need a budget that works for Oklahomans.
All right. David Blatt, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
David Blatt is the executive director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute. The Oklahoma Policy Institute is one member of the Save Our State Coalition, over 24 organizations, which have announced a state budget blueprint over the next 3 years to eliminate this year's shortfall and protect essential government services. For more information on their plan, visit saveourstateok.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.